afternoon. So we will resume our discussion about ensembles and phases in statistical mechanics. So let me spend 5 minutes reviewing what I did yesterday. So we started going to the origin of Gibbs distribution. What is the rationale behind that particular form? So I gave a derivation of Liouville's equation and Liouville's theorem, which suggested that the phase-space distribution function, which is what we use in statistical mechanics for calculations, will be functions of integrals of motions, namely energy and the momentum and angular momentum. And for standard statistical mechanical problem, we are focusing on zero net momentum and zero angular momentum. So we focus only on energy. So that gave us a very beautiful and simple form for the phase space distribution function, which is what, and the integral of that distribution function is the partition function. So yesterday I started then with the microcanonical ensemble. Conceptually, it's the simplest because it just tells you that count the volume of phase space in the case of classical mechanics. And in the context of quantum mechanics, count the number of states in a given energy interval around an energy. And that energy corresponds to the mean energy per degree of freedom of that quantum state or classical state. So once you have that information, just the number. In the case of classical mechanics, you can normalize it and make it dimensionless. This number has all you want to know about equilibrium statistical mechanics. And this is traditionally written as e to the power of minus entropy divided by Boltzmann constant. Because S is K log. So once you can count this, you know everything. And we can explicitly evaluate it for the case of free particles, which are governed by simple Hamiltonian dynamics. You have n particles. And then you can calculate the phase space volume, given the fact that particles live in a physical volume, and they have a constraint to have a total energy, which is, let's say, epsilon. And this energy per particle will be the internal energy of the system. And once you are given that internal energy E, you can find out what is the corresponding temperature. Normally, we ask the other way. Given the temperature, we calculate the energy. Here in this description, you give me the energy per particle, and then I can find out the temperature using the well-known relation that ds by dE is equal to 1 over T. So graphically, if I look at the S of E, let's say for a simple many-body system like spins, it will have a form. That is the least energy that the system can have per particle. This is the maximum energy it can have. So when I'm here, the slope is vertical. So that means zero temperature. And if you give me any internal energy, then what I do is I go up and find out the slope. That gives me the inverse of temperature. So if you take that logic, you come here, this corresponds to maximum temperature, namely infinite temperature. Then you can continue to go down. Then in the beta axis, or inverse temperature axis, you start going from positive value to negative value through this maxima. So this is very interesting that zero temperature is here, and zero temperature is also in some sense here. But when you approach it from negative side, it's somewhere else. And then, in some sense, as a function of beta, things are continuous. You go to beta equal to 0, and then beta becomes negative, and then infinity, and then infinity here. Okay. So this brings this beautiful concept of negative temperature. I have no time to discuss that. It is discussed in books like Kittel, and there are nice review articles. Even now, there are some people who question this notion and how it is incompatible with some general principles and so on. So there are some people even now thinking about it. Anyway, so, okay. So mathematically, what you do here is you know the function. You are supposed to know the function if you had solved the problem. And so in principle, you can find out E as a function of t, which is what we will call as internal energy as a function of t. So once you have internal energy and entropy, you can go back and substitute. You have E as a function. Then you can calculate free energy, which is ut minus ts. So this is the Helmholtz free energy. So in principle, if you know this, you know everything. You can calculate various thermodynamic quantities from microcanonical. Then yesterday I pointed out that when you go to canonical ensemble, for various reasons, one is a physical reason that your subsystem is never in a sharp energy state. It receives and gives out energy. So maybe one should include that, because that has some information about the medium in which we are focused and where we are focusing on a little bit of subsystem. So then it turns out, in addition to that physical requirement, even mathematically, calculating thermodynamic quantity through partition function is easier than counting number of states or phase space integration. And this is something that you see in real examples. So there, what you do is you say that, yes, you do count states, then you give it a spread. You say that there is a Lagrange multiplier, namely beta, which selects for you a range of epsilon e. And then this is your so-called partition function for an n-particle system. So here I should put an n. So this becomes a function of beta and system's parameter. And all information about interacting system or non-interacting system comes through this. And so you can get canonical partition function several ways. One is to go back to the definition of this quantity. And that is nothing but please remember, this is the original definition of omega e. And then now you interchange integrations. And then you get okay. And there are factors like h cross. So when you come to microcanonical ensemble, in principle, you do count the number of states, but as a function of energy, and then you weight it according to this factor. And that is supposed to be the so-called partition function, which when you rewrite it, becomes this. So here, you give equal a priori probability for all parts of phase space, but with this weightage. So it is this beta which selects you regions of phase space. And it turns out, as I pointed out yesterday, this, in terms of when you look at the profile of this, this quantity omega is e to the power of k, s by k. And s is intensive in the sense per spin, per particle. There's a finite amount, so e to the power of n. So it is this largeness which tells you that this product, as I pointed out yesterday, starts looking like a sharp function whose width vanishes in the thermodynamic limit. So essentially, what you are doing is your counting configuration, but at a particular energy, which is determined by this Lagrange multiplier beta, which we call as inverse of temperature. And you can already see very clearly for Ising models and for ideal gases, mathematical evaluation of this is much simpler than directly evaluating this. Okay. So this is what we saw yesterday. And then I did not go into grand canonical ensemble. It's basically one step beyond. So here what did I do? I counted the number of configurations and then gave a weightage and summed over all possible energies. And when you come to grand partition function, so what is the notation for it? Let me call it as Q tilde. You do something very similar. Then you start weighing with a chemical potential. So you have evaluated or you have done the counting of volume, finding the volume of phase space or counting the number of states around a given energy for a given number of particles. Then previously, you gave a Boltzmann weightage Lagrange multiplier through inverse of temperature. Now you say there is another parameter, chemical potential, which gives weightage for a particular number of particles, mean number of particles. Here again, the physics is saying that if I look at a big system and a subsystem, there will be not only exchange of energy, there will be also exchange of number of particles. This in a very natural way takes care of that. So here again, you can show that in the thermodynamic limit, this will peak around a particular mean value of n. Let's call it as n naught, which is going to be determined by chemical potential, temperature, and other quantities. So there will be a very tiny spread, which will vanish in the thermodynamic limit. So as before, there will be an energy, which is u, which will depend on mu, t, and other things. And the internal energy will peak around this value. The probability distribution function will peak around this mean value. And there will be an exponential, very small spread, which will vanish in the thermodynamic limit. So these are all the three things that we do. And it's interesting, we will see later when we come to superconductivity that doing with grand canonical ensemble in the case of superconductors and superfluid is more than a mathematical convenience, because it turns out in a superconductor, for all practical purposes, when you focus on a small volume, the number conservation is broken in the sense the particle number coherently fluctuates as the Cooper pairs go in and out. So there is a deep meaning there. We will come to it when we discuss later. So this is basically a review of what we did yesterday. So today, I am going to focus on this partition function, which is what we want to study in detail. So this is a partition function for classical interacting particles. Then if I want to study partition function for quantum system, I did not go into density matrices and various things, because since you are having quantum mechanics, you know quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. I will not focus on that, except to point out that according to Boltzmann, it basically says that you weigh every quantum energy eigenstate by this quantity. That is the probability that I will find the system at a given energy epsilon alpha depends is this quantity, e to the power of minus beta e alpha divided by the partition function. This is the probability. And if I sum over all possible energies, I will get unity. So it turns out this normalization constant is the partition function, and it gives us most of the macroscopic information that we want. So that's why we focus on partition function. We don't look at probability distribution function. We take the probability distribution, integrate over phase space. That contains material parameters like mass of the particle and interaction potential through the Hamiltonian, and it contains temperature through this parameter. So we just want normalization constant of a big probability distribution. Now, when it comes to quantum mechanics, all information about the system, the number of particles, and the nature of forces and everything comes through the energy eigenvalues. So we sum over all energy eigenvalues. We give equal importance, but weigh them according to this Boltzmann factor. So this is quantum partition function, and this is classical partition function. And in the next class, we will discuss this in some detail for the case of bosons and fermions and anions, which already you know, but I will try to give some different insight. So today, the rest of the time, we will talk about very interesting phases in real life for which a good understanding of this classical partition function is very useful. And then the next step is how to evaluate this partition function, because if you look at it, this is a multidimensional integral. You have n particles, so there are 6n degree of freedom, and this h, for example, is p square y over 2am. That's some one component system, and then some u ra minus rj. If I consider a helium gas, or if you consider argon gas, or if you consider methane gas, this is how it will be. So if the particle is spherical, this interaction is a central, it is a central force, or the central potential. It doesn't depend on the relative angle between the two particles. If it is non-central, then things become different. For example, if you look at a liquid crystal, very often you see them in the television display or in your cell phone display. There are molecules which are rod-like. So interaction between two molecules will depend on the relative orientation. If you consider water, for example, if you want to model, water carries a permanent dipole. So the interaction between them will depend on the relative orientation, not only the distance. So the potential will become very more complicated. But formally, this is what you have to do. You have to do this complicated multidimensional integral. And it turns out, when you do theoretical physics, multidimensional integrals will keep coming in different form, including functional integrals and integral over quantum fields and so on. So finally, it's integrating over some functions which contain several degree of freedom. In some sense, at each point, there is a degree of freedom, like a vector field. Or it could be some spin value, or it could be some velocity, and so on. Okay. So this is what we want to evaluate. So before we evaluate, let's digress a little bit and think about phases that we are already. I pointed out the simplest of phases that we know, namely. Liquid, gas, solid. And I focused a lot on this in terms of qualitative discussion that describes a critical point, that is, if you walk along this line, the difference between liquid and gas, that this difference vanishes at the critical point. And the way it vanishes is interesting. It defines a power in that is, it will vanish. Let me call it as a delta rho, vanish as some exponent, let me call it as alpha 1. It turns out this number alpha 1, we will discuss this in some detail later, is an universal number. It is independent of what kind of liquid gas you are considering, argon liquid and argon gas or water. As long as you live in three-dimensional world, most of the liquids have the same exponent. They don't carry dipole moment, they have the same exponent. So this is something universal about it. That is, the material property does not appear in this kind of so-called exponent. So this is something that excites physicists, because they are looking for universal principles and universal constants embedded in seemingly different systems. So this is, in fact, part of the critical phenomena that we will discuss. Okay. So this is a very interesting system. And then we will come later when we talk about symmetry breaking, nature of solid, and nature of different crystallography classifications, and so on. But now I want to point out to you another very simple simple system, which normally we don't bother, but it turns out it has profound implications, including in biology and our own life. So I will very briefly point out. In some books, they discuss this. It's basically a liquid mixture. Suppose you take olive oil and pour water. You all know that they don't mix. But if you look inside, suppose, let's say, I don't know which is denser. Olive oil is denser? Anybody? Okay, I think let's say this is olive oil is denser, and then there is water. So they don't mix. But if you do careful experiment, what you find is some olive oil molecules manage to go here, and some water molecules also manage to come down. So the right thing to say is, this is oil rich and this is water rich. Okay, you take this system and then slowly heat it. And you will find, keep rest of the thing the same, you will find at some point the interface between the thing starts, you know, started wandering around, and at some point they completely mix. A very simple phenomena. Back home, you know, there were lots of experiments done with in a neighboring laboratory with water and kerosene, because kerosene is a very cheap liquid. Olive oil is a little more expensive, so kerosene is cheap, so you can do the experiment, and several PhDs were produced. Professor E.S. Rajagopal's group at Indian Subscience, where I did my PhD, amazingly simple system. You can have wonderful control experimentally and calculate critical exponents, which people struggle very hard to find out through neutron scattering experiments and sophisticated experiments. So this simple binary liquid allows you for rich physics. Now when they start mixing, you will start seeing this becoming very turbid and very milky. And that is called critical opalescence. What happens is the densities of these two objects are different. But when they start mixing, there are regions where it's mostly olive oil, regions where it is water, distributed over various length scales. And particularly at the critical point, they are distributed at all length scale, including the length scale of our visible light, which is like 5,000 angstrom unit and around. So they efficiently scatter all wavelength uniformly. So you start seeing milky white phenomena. This is called critical opalescence. So my good friends in the neighboring lab actually were studying this. So I used to, you know, talk to them and discuss some theory. But I thought it's an academic thing. Then once I heard a visitor, in fact, I'm very, very happy to see his webpage. He's still active. He must be more than 80. George Benedek from MIT. He gave a wonderful talk at our institute about the relevance of critical opalescence in the phenomenon of cataract. See, as you know that when people get old, the lens which is transparent starts becoming opaque. In fact, if you examine the eye carefully, what you will find, it becomes very turbid or milky. And his point, in fact, his lab spent several, continued to work on that field. As you know, biological systems contain proteins. They have few nanometer dimensions. And the proteins are supposed to do a lot of work, so they're produced in some place. They traverse through the biological medium. So in some sense, they uniformly mix and they go around and keep doing their job. In the eye, which develops cataract, they start crowding together. So what happens is, you can think about, it's an idealization. You know, biology is much more complicated than what I'm saying. But this part is dominant. There is some background fluid in which the second component, namely proteins, have some finite density. They are mixed uniformly. They are running around and doing their job. Now, with aging, some parameter changes in the background liquid. It could be pH value, that is density of some positive or negative ions or some other parameter. And what it does is it pushes you towards the point in which they start phase separating. So before that, let me give you the phase diagram. For liquid gas, you know, you have the famous phase diagram, pressure versus volume. So above the critical temperature, you have almost an ideal gas like equation of state. And at T equal to Tc, the so-called isotherm, that is this curve represents the equation of state for a given fixed value of temperature, namely Tc, and it goes through the so-called critical point. Now, if your temperature is below Tc, when you come here, it's phase separate, you hit this point. You phase separates into liquid and gas, and here it's completely liquid, and here it's completely, sorry, here it's completely liquid, it's completely gas. So this is a famous isotherm that you learn in elementary thermodynamics. Now, in the case of binary mixtures, the isotherm is again like this, but now it's as a function of relative concentration of one with respect to the other. That is, I take water and add a fraction x of olive oil. And in this region, so at very high temperature, they will mix thoroughly. If I go, I don't want to go into the microscopic origin. It is to do with entropy. It is to do with repulsion between molecules, attraction between the two types of molecules, and so on. But at the end of the day, this is what phenomenologically happens. At very high temperature, the two liquids completely mix, and then there is a critical point. And then below that temperature, they phase separate. For example, the picture I had was corresponds to some temperature here, where you have a hydrogen, olive oil rich region and water rich liquid. It is here, when you pass through this point, like the critical point, you have this critical opalescence. So when I heard that, it was very exciting that what we learn in statistical mechanics can have some implication for real life phenomena. So what they do is, so they try to push the parameters so that you move from here, you come somewhere here, you don't enter this region. If you enter this region, things will agglomerate into protein-rich region and protein-poor region. Then the proteins or enzymes won't do their job. So it's as simple as that. Now, recently, while preparing for this talk, and I heard some talks earlier, that this is ubiquitous in biology. You talk about Alzheimer's disease. They're basically proteins which are supposed to, amyloids and so on, which are supposed to do some function because of the change in the environment. Very simple things like pH value and some other new solute coming, they start aggregating. This aggregation is not a physical, you know, covalent bond or anything. They just would like to get stuck together and minimize entropy. So many of these physics is related to the fight between entropy and internal energy. So entropy comes in a big way. And once you have these proteins aggregating and not doing their job, things break down. Biologically, you have many things happening. And I was reading an article yesterday that where this is only one of the things. There are many, many ailments in biology where these aggregations play a very important and bad role. There are times in which they're important. Things have to aggregate and they don't have to do some work. So many interesting things happen. So this is a liquid mixture. So the statistical mechanics of this itself is very, very interesting. And this can be also modeled in terms of Ising model. There are critical exponents and so on, but they have real life implications. OK. Having said this, something about simple phases. So you have liquid gas and liquid mixture. Now let me go on to the task that a theoretical physicist have, namely to evaluate this partition function.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Do you know this also applied
to
cosmology? Formation of galaxies and clusters of galaxies?
Yes, OK. Thanks for it. So if you, as you enter Perimeter Institute, you have this beautiful screen. So people talk about large-scale structures. So there are very natural aggregations and hierarchical scales. There, the physics is slightly different because of attractive forces. So for some time scales, you can use many of these methodologies and things. Thanks for, yeah, it is true in, so it seems to be true from large to small scale. I don't know when quantum strings will aggregate. Maybe they will do, I don't know, at the smallest scale. Okay, so now I will come to evaluating partition function. Before we evaluate partition function and before we knew partition function, van der Waals, we knew ideal gas equation of state and we were having a happy life. Boyle's law. So pressure and volume occupied by one particle and Boltzmann constant and temperature. And it turns out this equation is valid only in this region. There is no way by which it can show the existence of a liquid and gas as distinct objects, distinct phases. So van der Waals worried about it. Last night I was reading his Nobel lecture. He got his Nobel Prize in 1910 for a thesis which he wrote, I believe, in 1880 or around in the neighborhood, before people knew about experimentally proved existence of atoms and molecules. Van der Waals had good insights, and he wrote a thesis which came as a book, in which he asked the question, okay, this is what thermodynamics tells me, equation of state. What kind of modification that I will give to this in order to explain the experimental phenomenology, namely existence of liquid and gas, coexistence, and critical point? So he thought for a while and thought deeply about it, taking some clues from earlier masters. I will not go into the details. So he said, so I can rewrite this equation of state as P divided. So he said, I could make one phenomenological modification. So V is the volume occupied by one molecule or one atom. So his argument is that as a molecule, I have some volume, and other molecules have volume. So the amount of space that I can explore is not exactly my volume, the area given to me, it is that minus some number. So this could typically be the volume of a molecule. So some parameter which is atomic scale phenomena. So for the first time, van der Waals introduced some parameter which is angstrom unit parameter. And fortunately, experimental results are available. So you could fit it to those things and get some number which will tell you dimensions of molecules, like 3 angstrom cube or 10 angstrom cube. Then he also wanted to make another modification. Basically, he said that in a real system, we don't have ideal gas. The molecules have some very short-range repulsion. Perhaps they have some attraction. And it's very fitting to the same van der Waals who discovered van der Waals attraction later, using quantum mechanics and so on. So he said, that will effectively reduce the pressure. And that pressure reduction should be a two-body event. That is, the least is 2 atoms or 2 molecules coming close by. So it should be something proportional to density square. So he said, the actual pressure will be reduced by an amount, which is some parameter A, 1 over V square, which is density square. So it's a phenomenological modification, as simple as that. So this got him Nobel Prize, because it turned out this equation already brought in universality. This is so this is a famous a curve in this PV plane. So what he did was, he took variety of liquids and gases available at that time, including air, benzene, and so on, and get universal parameter, that is, normalize this B with respect to some universal volume and this parameter with respect to some parameter, and put everything in a universal fashion, and everything fell on a single curve. This was a remarkable thing, that finding similarity or universality among variety of systems. So that's where he got Nobel Prize. Okay. Now we would like to see how this comes about from our partition function approach. And in the process, we will come to a very interesting situation, which is these days getting emphasized, that the pressure of an ideal gas has an entropy origin rather than mechanistic. We are told, when we think about pressure, that is, you say that there is a container, the atoms and molecules collide against the walls of the container, and they impart some force because there is a mean kinetic energy. That is true. But in addition to that, there is a very, very important component to this thermodynamic pressure, which is coming purely from change in entropy. In fact, I will elaborate on it a little later. So now let me see how I can get this kind of equation of state by looking at expression for partition function. Let me again go back to the expression, some constant. Then because I have a classical system, I only focus on so Uij means Ura. From Q, I will go to R. So in the absence of this, I will simply get a volume factor. Because this U interaction is 0, so I simply get volume factor. Now, it's very easy to see. Okay. Now, let me look at the integrand. So let me take instantaneous positions of this gas or liquid molecule. And then I am here. Let me say I am the ith molecule. So when I do the integration, what do? I move around. Then whenever I approach this molecule, there is strong repulsive potential. So the Boltzmann factor will vanish exponentially fast. Because, for example, let me also tell you about this potential. One of the popular potential is called so-called Lennard-Jones potential, which has a repulsion at short distances, which as a function of separation Rij goes at the 12th power. So Rij is Ri minus Rj. Then at long distances, it experiences an attraction, which goes as 6th power. So if I draw a graph, it will look like this. So there is a very strong repulsion below some length scale, which is given by this A and B. And then there is a long attractive tail. So because of this particular form, this starts diverging, becoming larger and larger. So it's exponential of minus. So it becomes smaller and smaller. So as I do my integration, for a fixed configuration of this, basically I'm excluding some region for me. It's very simple, as simple as that. That means the volume that I will get is reduced by basically some volume, which is n is the number of other atoms times volume of other atoms. So essentially it means crudely, now because I'm doing this integration with respect to freezing the other particle. I'll have to do the other particle. When things cluster, this approximation may not work. But at the first level approximation, this is like a mean field approximation. What I get is some times number times mean. So this is what you can rationalize it in this fashion. Then this is slightly different. It says that whenever particles come close by, there is some attraction. So maybe they will spend more time there. So correspondingly, the potential energy will go down. You gain potential energy, and kinetic energy may increase to conserve the total energy of the system. So this takes care of this. Now, there are formal ways of getting this, which is called Mayer's cluster expansion. I'll just indicate that and then go to the next topic. In fact, this is, as Mattis in his book says, this is the beginning of diagrammatics that we are so fond of in quantum field theory and in many body physics. So now I would like to evaluate this integral. And it turns out this integral, as I said, is ubiquitous in many body theory, quantum many body theory. In fact, there are examples. Suppose I want to study liquid helium 4, which is a very well known superfluid. It exhibits superfluidity, it exhibits supersolidity, and variety of interesting phenomena, conceptually very rich. If I want to understand the ground state properties, and many of these properties I mentioned, it is sufficient if we evaluate an integral like this. And the way it comes is very beautiful, and I will mention it and then come back. Sorry for this digression, but this is what made Feynman and others very famous in the context of helium problem. So now I am asking a very different question. That is, I have a collection, I have a liquid. This is a liquid of helium atoms. And quantum mechanics tells me, you have learned in quantum mechanics courses, they are identical particles. So they have a description in terms of wave function. And that wave function should be symmetric with respect to interchange of coordinates. That's a fundamental requirement. Further, there is a very famous theorem that a ground state wave function of a standard many body problem involving simple interactions should be nodeless. In the sense, the wave function should not change sign if you move in configuration space. Well-known examples. For example, if you take a harmonic oscillator, the ground state is a simple Gaussian. If you take hydrogen atom, the ground state is a very simple, again, exponentially decaying, nodeless, featureless. And you go to excited state, you get node. So you can use that argument to show that this wave function should be nodeless. So two requirements. One is it is symmetric, and another is it is nodeless. Then immediately it suggests you a form which is very similar to this partition function that we are looking at. Okay. So what is another property about helium atom? When the two helium atoms come close by, there is a hardcore repulsion. Or there is a Lennard-Jones repulsion. So the probability of finding two helium atoms at below some distance should become smaller and smaller. So how will I model it? I will say that so this contains, it satisfies the necessary constraint for me. It says it is symmetric with respect to interchange of coordinates. Okay, by definition, that is right. That is satisfied. And I also choose a phi, which is positive definite. So I choose a phi, for example, as a function of the separation, which is like this. Basically, there is some distance a naught, which is like the size of the atom. So the wave function will vanish very fast below that scale. And then after that, they will move like free particles. So both informations are contained in this. Now you can rewrite it as exponential of log of, and then this starts looking like a partition function. And in particular, we are interested in evaluating correlation functions, two-point functions in this many-body state. But before that, as always, if you find the normalization constant, namely psi star psi, already that has many, many useful information, including possibility of solidification and so on. So another problem occurring elsewhere, namely ground state property of interacting helium atom, which carries rich physics, is equivalent to a classical statistical mechanics problem as far as evaluating integrals are concerned. It's a multidimensional integrals. So here, your classical atoms moves in real space controlled by a Boltzmann factor and two-body potential. Here, a quantum particle moves in real space. It's controlled by some amplitudes like this phi. And in fact, there is a whole school group of many groups in the world who work on this wave function, how to evaluate it, how to calculate averages, how to make it better and better. So I will just point out how this is dealt with in classical liquids, which is a very physical approach. It says that let us rewrite this Boltzmann factor as 1 plus. I add and subtract 1 and call this as Fij. Then my partition function becomes this is my partition function. The reason I did this is if I look at given this u, the behavior of Fij will be something like this. So in most of the region in space, this will be 0. You can convince yourself because this will become 1. Epsilon will become 1 in most of the region. Then it will have a slight increase, and then it will eventually go back to minus 1 when this vanishes. So as I'm dealing with a dilute gas or weakly interacting or dilute system, this function f should take small value. So it will be good to make an expansion in powers of this f. So this is a product over all pairs. So if you expand it, you will have a 1. And then, okay, the corresponding integral, which will look like ideal gas, then you will have Fij, then Fij, Fkl, non-overlapping, and then an overlapping part, which is Fij, Fjk, and so on. So in fact, you are tempted to write a diagram for each term, because imagine the positions of the particles, just some, choose some way of tagging the particle, let's say it's a particle 1, 2, 3, and so on. So this term says that 3 and 7 are connected. And then you do that integration over the two coordinate, and then do this for every pair. So here, two pairs occur. They are disjoint. Here, a pair like this occur, three of them, 1, 2, 3. So they share a common coordinate, and so on. So you can systematically organize this expansion and do calculations. And this is called virial expansion or Mayer's cluster expansion. And what is interesting is before modern phase transition theory came, namely Ansager solutions and other insights, people seriously working on this even doubted whether this approach of Boltzmann partition function is ever capable of predicting a phase transition, which is a phenomenon of singularity in some parameter, like temperature. Because if you do anything perturbative, it's very difficult for you to develop singularity. So you'll have to do infinite summation or partial summation. So it is in this context people like Li and Yang came, and many, many nice things happened. So I just wanted to point out that there are serious attempts to calculate partition function in perturbative fashion. And doing and in fact, quantum chemists spend a lot of time. And even people doing numeric, suppose I want to evaluate this partition function numerically for 100 particle system, 200 particle system, some of these schemes will work very well. When you do molecular dynamics or when you do other schemes, these things will work. So there is a whole approach to solve this problem, organize this term, hypernetted chain approximation, and this and that, and a density functional theory. So there is a whole variety. I will just point it out and now come back to, for the rest of the time, about what I mentioned as entropic origin of forces, because this turns out to be also something very important.
Okay.
Any question? Yeah.
But can you actually get van der Waals equation out of this expansion or not?
Yes. So if you look at textbooks, including the books by Pauli and other, they basically get van der Waals equation by looking at the first term. But then what they miss is that, that is, they get this part of van der Waals equation correct, but not this part.
Yeah, exactly. So, so the A part is simple, right? But
exactly.
The B minus B part is...
This is the difficult part.
Yeah.
If you want to do this, in principle, you'll have to do a partial summation of this and make some approximation. And then that should turn out to be a power series, like 1 over B minus B. So the in the books, people say that you can derive van der Waals equation. They, what they mean is the following, that they get, by picking a few terms, they get E equal to kT. So if you pull out V, then you have V times 1 minus B by V. Now we can make an expansion, assuming B by V is very small. Then in which case, the leading term will be this. So this is what you can get from by keeping the first term. But then it's suggestive, like you know, in many perturbative theories, that you look at one diagram, then it suggests what should be the other diagrams. You can do partial summation and then develop terms like this, which has poles. Interestingly, this is interesting because what this term does is, in the equation of state, in the standard ideal gas equation of state, P versus V for a given temperature, P is equal to KT divided by V. So it diverges as V tends to 0 when you make that. Whereas according to van der Waals theory, it starts diverging at a point which is B, which is related to the volume of the molecule. So you clearly create a new divergence. And then the presence of 1 over R squared term gives you this. Okay. Yeah. That remains, thanks for this question, because it reminds me about something that I missed, so-called Maxwell's construction. If you take van der Waals equation seriously and plot so-called isotherm, you find a problem, which was noticed by people like Maxwell. So if I take van der Waals equation and then plot V as a function, at very high temperature, there is no problem. Then when I go to low temperature, I find isotherm like this. So here, there is a problem in this region. It is here, if I increase the density, pressure decreases, or V is inverse of density. So if you increase the density, yeah. So it's counterintuitive. Normally, if I apply pressure, the density should increase. Here it's the other way. So this is called unstable region. So this is not thermodynamically stable. That is, if you think about compressibility, it's negative. The system will spontaneously come. So Maxwell pointed out that things are not that. But what is actually happening is, the following. That is, you can make sense out of this equation by the following construction. You say that you draw a line such that this area is equal to this area. So hypothesis. Then look at the locus of this. And that will be the isotherm that you observe experimentally. That is, at this point, and at this point, it's such that this area is equal to, Maxwell gives rational by saying that the amount of work done in coming here, it's the same as this. Finally, it is to do with phase separation. That is, if you come here, we start with some amount of matter, some of them will become liquid, some of them will become gas. Locally, both have same free energy. That is what we learn from thermodynamics. So one has very low density. So it has, so that's interesting. That is, the free energy of a liquid is the same as free energy of gas at the coexistence point. How is it possible? Because a liquid has a lot of attractive interaction, a lot of energy coming from attraction. Whereas a gas has no attraction, it's very dilute. So, and this is U minus Ts, and this is also U minus Ts. So they become identical because of difference in entropy. A gas has much more entropy than a liquid. So that's why, interesting, the free energy at that point, they're identical numerically. So Maxwell gave a way of rationalizing van der Waals equation, and he said that, or you can use Maxwell's construction to rationalize van der Waals equation and have this. Now there is an interesting point here. This is related to so-called cooling or superheating. That is, you can take water, and if you heat it very gently without producing impurities and nucleation centers, you can push the temperature beyond 100 Celsius. Similarly, you can take gas and, you know, do the other way. So which amounts to saying that there is another line, which I got by taking the locus of this minima and maxima. This represents superheating and super cooling situation. And this is called spinoidal line. This line, because this is something very important metallurgically. In metallurgy, you take two metals, two elements, and the corresponding metal, and heat them and mix them, and then form various combinations. And then you suddenly find there are regions in which they don't mix, but they undergo fantastic decomposition in terms of spatial patterns, like spinoidal decomposition. So this is a very famous thing in the context of metallurgy. We will not go into the details. So this is a point I wanted to point out, that van der Waals equation does bring with it some anomalous features which can be corrected if you use Maxwell's construction. Okay. Now let me go to the issue of entropy that I was pointing out. So if you evaluate free energy of ideal Bose gas, you get internal energy, which is 3/2 kT. Then the expression for entropy is somewhat long, which we have already seen, minus T. Plus some constants which are related to 3/2 Even though the equation of states looks very simple, the actual free energy expression looks complicated. But if you look at the origin of this volume, this comes from configuration space integration of n particle coordinates. So what is the definition of pressure in thermodynamics? It is keep the temperature as the same and change the volume, and that is what gives you pressure. And then you get essentially Pv equal to kT. And this V simply comes from this factor, this n in the denominator came from n factorial, and the V came from integration mode configuration space. Each particle gives you one volume, and V to the power of n, and then finally you get this. So it's very strange. The mechanical pressure that I'm measuring has its origin in entropy, rather than the thing that we think in terms of collision. So you have an interacting gas, it is true. But if you go to the limit, you have an ideal gas, which has just sufficiently weak interaction to equilibrate. Otherwise, they are not strongly interacting. And there, the origin of pressure is entropic. Please think about it. I don't understand it deeply, but there is another well-known example which is given in textbooks, which is rubber elasticity. You take a rubber band and you pull it, you do feel a force. Now we can ask the question, is there any difference between that force of a metallic spring? Suppose I have a spring made up of a solid, let's say some very good spring. I pull it, and I often associate this force with respect with the elastic force with what is going on at the level of atoms and molecules that forms the spring, and at the level of motions of dislocations and other things. So it's very mechanistic. Temperature and other things don't play a major role. Whereas if it turns out, if you take a rubber band, which is some kind of polymer, one of them is like this. When you stretch this by some distance x, what you are doing is the following. In our time scales, the rubber band is exploring its own configuration space. When it was not elongated, it explored some amount of configuration space, and it had some amount of entropy, and so it that entropy contributed so much to the free energy. Now, when I pull the rubber band, what I'm doing is I am changing, I'm removing its freedom, I'm making it, giving it less opportunity to explore the thing, because I make, for example, the extreme limit, I pull it into a straight line, the entropy of the polymer is zero, the configuration entropy. So it's indeed amazing that a good part of rubber elasticity is entropic in origin. In fact, this is at the heart of some of the recent developments. People, maybe David will talk about it at the end. There is so-called emergent gravity. I have heard about it from my friend Padmanabhan, who is at and then this lately, a lot of this talked about by Ferlinde. I don't understand this field, but the statement is there is something deeply thermodynamical about the very space-time and the gravitational interaction. After all, the gravitational force is entropic in origin. So there is a thermodynamic origin. People talk about it. So I just wanted to point out, so you can view my course as some kind of random walk also. You know, there is a regular walk, but I am doing some random walk. But this is, you know, it will interest people that the simple thermodynamics and simple rubber elasticity and ideal gas notions is going much beyond its place of birth. OK. So this is something that I wanted to do. So I have just spent 1 hour. I think that's, since you had a long class before me, I think I'll stop here. Because I have basically covered whatever I wanted to do. I wanted to go in some depth to this approximate evaluation of partition function. But I think that will take more time than I expect. But I will stop here, except to point out that the Boltzmann, you know, Gibbs prescription has given us a way to understand a variety of interesting phenomena in statistical mechanics. And we talk about critical phenomena. Critical phenomena occurs not only in liquid gas and magnets, ferroelectrics. They also occur in simple liquid mixtures. It has interesting implications in fields like biology and wherever, you know, aggregation occurs. So you seem to be pushed to below this region where things phase separate, and if it close to the critical point, it phase separates in several sizes, then that is critical opalescence. It's bad for the eye, and also bad for the functioning of neurons and so on. Thank you. So I'll be happy to answer your questions. OK. Thank you.